Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your moderator for today's program. We also welcome our listeners on radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Michael Krasny is the host of KQED Radio's Forum program and author of the new book, Spiritual Envy, An Agnostic's Quest. As a radio talk show host, they don't get any better than Dr. Michael Krasny. As the erudite host of KQED's award-winning morning radio talk show Forum, he covers politics, culture, the arts, health, business, and technology topics. Forum is one of KQED's most popular shows and the nation's most listened to locally produced public radio talk shows. Not only is Michael a man of many talents, but many jobs. He is not only a very popular tenured English professor at San Francisco State University, but an author as well. He has written Off Mic, his memoir of talk radio and literary life, and has also co-authored a textbook entitled Sound Ideas. Part of his life is spent battling city traffic as he shuttles between home, the radio station, and the university. His preparation for the Forum radio show entails keeping a constant eye on the breaking news and trends, reading the latest novels by authors he interviews, and generally being acutely aware of what is going on everywhere. KQED producer Raul Ramirez once said, and I quote, "In a week's time, Michael will absorb and discuss knowledgeably more ideas and facts than many of us confront in 6 months." And what does he do in his spare time, one might ask? Well, in addition to raising two daughters, Michael is widely known as a facilitator and host in the corporate sector and as a moderator for many nonprofit events. Michael Krasny has interviewed many of the leading newsmakers and cultural icons of our time, and that includes former President Jimmy Carter, Cesar Chavez, Hillary Rodham Clinton, Norman Mailer, Saul Bellow, former Vice President Al Gore, President Barack Obama, and believe me, the list goes on and on. He grew up in Cleveland Heights, and one might say acknowledges with a certain degree of pleasure his bad boy reputation. His father was a worker in an ice cream factory, and according to Michael, wanted nothing more from his son than a good education and a professional white-collar job. Michael Krasny graduated high school from Cleveland Heights High School, earned his BA and master's degree cum laude from Ohio University, where he is a member of Phi Beta Kappa, and he holds a PhD in 20th century literature from the University of Wisconsin. His wife, Leslie, is an attorney. And now, to talk about his newest book, Spiritual Envy, An Agnostic's Quest, please welcome Dr. Michael Krasny.
Thank you, Joe, and thank you all for being here, especially you Giants fans. It's a true testament to your loyalty to whatever it is I do every morning if you're here and you're a Giants fan, and I appreciate you being here, whatever reason you're here. In fact, I know that it may take a little bit of getting used to hearing this voice with this face for those of you who don't know this face, but you'll get accustomed as I talk for a little bit more. I was talking before I came up here with Joe Epstein and George Dobbins, who works here at the Commonwealth Club, about a woman friend of mine, and a woman named Jeanette Gittler, actually, who George used to work with and I used to work with. I used to have a TV show here in San Francisco on Bay TV, which is now just a distant memory. It was part of KRON television. And it was called Take Issue. It was a news program that was broadcast nightly on weeknights. And Jeanette Gittler was always seemed to me an uncommonly special kind of person in so many ways. And what struck me about her was just her general sense of kindness and compassion and decency. And, you know, those things can go a long way. And goodness. Little did I know, and we were talking about this, that she decided just going to a hair salon and a place where her nails were done and her hair was done, a beauty salon, I guess you call it. She was told by the woman who used to do her hair and her nails and things that the woman faced a pretty serious kidney disease and was, I guess, pretty disconsolate about the fact that this was going to kill her because she couldn't find someone compatible in her family to do a kidney transplant. And Jeanette said, well, how about if we see if I'm compatible with you in terms of kidney? And they were. And here, for someone that she didn't really know that well, she gave her kidney to and underwent a pretty serious and, in many ways, I think one could safely say, traumatic operation. And I'm struck by that story still for so many reasons, one of them just being the general goodness that leads somebody to do something like that. The kindness, the altruism, the sense of, well, responsibility for another human being or wanting to sacrifice, literally a kidney. Every year I am involved in the National Kidney Foundation luncheon, and I said you should have Jeanette be a speaker this year. And I'm not here to talk about Jeanette's good deeds, but I wanted to tell you that one of the things that set off this book of mine was trying to figure out why be good or why act with a sense of kindness, decency, compassion, all those kinds of things that we like to think our civilization and the best of our civilization is built upon. And it struck me that I didn't really have a theological basis for that. I didn't have an undergirding of faith to build that kind of code upon. And I really realized to what extent I found a code of my own. And I wanted to pretty much speak about what that was and how that came to be. So that was one of the reasons that I got involved in writing this book. Why are we good? Why does it need... I had made the choice a long time ago to do things like public service and to be an educator. Part of it has to do with the way I'm wired. I just happen to like those things and have passion about them and be good in them. But also I wanted to do good, and I wanted and continue to want to, at least in some fashion, be of public service and do things for my community and do things that will make a difference and have impact. But you could just as easily, it seemed to me, make a decision not to do good. Or, I mean, free will is clearly kind of tied into this to a great extent. I remember I asked the Nobel laureate writer Isaac Bashevis Singer in an interview I did at the Herbst Theater, and I was really quite serious and sober about this. I said, "Do you believe in free will, Mr. Singer?" And he said, "I have no choice." And it, in many ways, epitomizes a kind of paradox that we think of, perhaps, when we do think of exercising our free will. So I found myself kind of getting on a jag of, why be good? You know, Iago, I've taught Othello for many years, and Iago said, "I'll make evil my good." And there's something about demonic energy that can be very attractive. It is a sort of magnetic energy. Iago's a much more interesting character in many ways than Desdemona, if I can use Shakespeare as an example, who's virtuous and who's wonderful and good, but nevertheless not nearly as interesting in her... She doesn't have the guile, the cunning. She doesn't have the deceitfulness. She doesn't have all of those things that somehow, as T.S. Eliot once said, have a life force of their own. So in all of my literary background and in what has been a lifetime of questing and searching for knowledge and trying to figure out what I believed in, I thought, why not sit down and try to write about the big questions, what my publisher calls the 3 o'clock in the morning questions, or maybe even 3:30 in the morning. And I began to struggle with what is good and evil, really, and what about the nature of existence and God and the Ten Commandments and time, you know, the trivial questions. And first I wanted to see if I could establish a sense of an anchoring in some kind of belief itself. I thought, what do I believe or what do I not believe? And there's this whole zeitgeist of atheists now, you know, telling us God does not exist, telling us that religion is foolish. Christopher Hitchens says there ought to be a war against religion, and Sam Harris, who has a new book out, Neuroscience, Atheism, talked about science having to destroy religion, and Richard Dawkins talked about religion as a form of child abuse. It seemed to me too hyperbolic, too extreme on the one hand. On the other hand, I said, how can they prove a negative? You know, you say there is no God, or God, you can say, I know for a fact that God is just like Santa Claus or just like leprechauns or the Easter Bunny, and so, and it, Many atheists do. But you can't prove a negative. And even now, with Stephen Hawking's new book, I thought to myself, here's probably one of the greatest geniuses alive on our planet saying to us, I'm an atheist now. He had been agnostic. And the reason I'm an atheist is because we don't need God to explain the Big Bang. The Big Bang was preceded probably by gravity. And I almost reflexively, like knee-jerk, said, yeah, but how did gravity come to exist? So I found myself struggling with these kinds of questions and deciding what my life has been like up until this point has been trying to cast light on many things. It's what I do as an educator. It's what I do as a broadcast journalist. It's what I try to do as a writer. So I'm looking for light here in this book. And I remembered a statement by Julian Barnes, a British novelist, which really caught my imagination and made me very attentive. He said, I don't believe in God, but I miss him. And that began to have a very resonant effect on me because I thought, I'm not sure if I believe in God or don't believe in God. You know, if I'm in a foxhole, I might believe in God. I found myself looking towards some kind of higher power in my helplessness when my children were born because I wanted them to be born healthy. I felt that sense of being drawn into some kind of higher sphere or wanting to be drawn into it. When we had the Cuban Missile Crisis and I was a college student, freshman, giving away my age here. But I didn't know because I didn't have any intellectually reason to believe that there was a God. I didn't have any kind of a priori proof. I didn't have any evidence with my six senses. I didn't really have any of that to confirm. And my friend Jacob Needleman, who's also a professor at San Francisco State, a philosophy professor, says there's inner empiricism. You don't always need external empiricism. You can believe subjectively in your heart. You can believe in your emotions. You can believe intuitively. You can believe by some kind of leap of faith. It never happened to me. I waited a lifetime and hoped that maybe, you know, I'd have some transcendent mystical moment or something that would really be a flash, like some Blakeian energy that would come to me and suddenly I would see in a visionary way what I needed to see mystically or in some other fashion. I was ready to take it through knowledge, intellect, or through my emotions if it would come to me. Never did. And so there's been this split in my life, I recognize, between what my intellect told me, which was nothingness, all of the things that one reads in writers like Hemingway and Beckett and Sartre, and a desire for something higher and a belief in something higher and a belief in the nobility of the spirit. I mean, to me, agnosticism was a kind of, it was a word I associated with a lot of jokes. The old Mort Sahl line, which I always think of about a family of agnostics that moves in a neighborhood and someone burns a question mark on their lawn. You know, Woody Allen saying an agnostic and an atheist got married and it didn't work out because they didn't know what not to raise the kid in, you know. I started, in fact, getting jokes when people found out I was writing a book. An old teaching partner of mine, Harvey Peskin, who's a psychologist in Berkeley, said, you know about the agnostic mortuary, remains to be seen. And I also remembered an interview I had with the great Studs Terkel, who's been dead a few years now, when he said, I'm an agnostic. And I said, I'd like to know what that means to you. You know, can you define what agnosticism is? And he said, yeah, it's a cowardly atheist. But I thought, maybe it's not so cowardly. Maybe, in fact, it takes a certain modicum, or maybe more than a modicum of courage, to say, I don't know. Right? My dad used to say that to me. My dad used to say to me, just say I don't know, because there are so many things you don't know. And, you know, I'm a fairly overeducated guy, and I can tell you that the more I've learned through the years and the more knowledge that I've acquired through the years, the more ignorant I've realized I am. I don't know so many things about the planet I live on. And I'm not just talking about knowledge that I could acquire, especially now with the digital speed of the internet. I'm talking about not knowing what's in the ocean bottom and not knowing why birds migrate or follow a certain trajectory, how they do it, not knowing why emperor penguins mate the way they do, not knowing the mysteries of the human heart, especially when it goes against itself, let alone thinking about what's out there in space, because, again, it's infinite. Maybe it may even be something that we can't encompass with our minds, because infinity is something that we certainly can't conceptualize. And so there's so much within, without, that's unknown to us. And I thought, why not just say, I mean, Nancy Reagan said, just say no. Why not just say, I don't know? Okay? That's sort of the spirit of this book. I had lunch with a friend of mine kind of a Midas touch guy who was very wealthy. And he said, "Oh, Michael, you're writing another scholarly book with a lot of questions?" I said, "Yeah, I'm bristling with questions. They've been, you know, haunting me my whole life." He said, "People buy books with answers." And I said, "Well, I guess I'm out of luck then, because this is a book that has a lot of questions." There's an old joke, in fact. You can use it actually about Jews or psychiatrists. It's one of these great jokes that fits both categories. I'll start with Jews because it has more of that kind of Jackie Mason quality to it, and that is, why does a Jew always answer a question with another question? Why shouldn't a Jew answer a question with another question? All right. But you could say that about a psychiatrist, too. Why shouldn't a psychiatrist answer a question with another question? In other words, the question always leads to the next question, and the question always feeds into the next question, and there's a kind of ad infinitum reeling off along those lines. And I found myself exploring all these big questions, but also thinking, boy, agnosticism makes sense in a lot of ways. I wasn't writing a polemic about agnosticism, but I was thinking to myself, what about the paranormal? What do we really know about our sixth sense or about all of these things we read about, you know, white lights coming and near-death experiences or telekinesis or people who have been aboard alien ships having various cavities looked into? It's always sort of a proctology exam of some kind. Where is the proof? Where is the ocular proof? Where is the sense that any of this is verifiable or even in some fashion incontrovertible? And the fact is, it's not there. And it's funny because both of my parents were really very devout believers, and they had strong faith right up until the end. My father, even in his dementia, believed that God was punishing him when he was in pain and when he was suffering, that God was judging him, that God was up there in his heaven, not necessarily all right with the world, but nevertheless this concrete personal God that so many of us grew up with, this anthropomorphic God that, like Voltaire said, we invent and have invented because if God invented us, we had to invent God. And my dad would be there studying the Bible assiduously, and at one point I said to him, "Dad, why are you reading Scripture so much now at this stage?" And he said, "Because I'm studying for my final exams." So I wanted to understand things that perhaps are beyond, at least at this point, our comprehension. And that doesn't mean that there aren't new frontiers to explore that can bring illumination and bring light to some of these imponderables. But at this point, so many of these things do remain imponderable. And I remember talking to the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Jane Smiley about this, and she said, "Well, I used to be an agnostic, but now I really don't care. I'm an indifferentist." She said, I'm just indifferent. And you know, that's certainly a viable position, I think. Many people have come around to that. But I'm still a seeker, and I still, for whatever way I'm wired or whatever way it's a blessing or a curse, to use those words, I still feel I want to find out what is in the essence of this. And because of what I do on the radio, so often having to do with conversations and keeping a certain level of discourse conversationally, I've realized that just talking about this subject has engendered an extraordinary number of conversations. Writing about it has engendered an extraordinary number of conversations. I was on Talk of the Nation recently, and I was amazed at the response. People who want to tell their stories about their struggles with faith. And these are many people who have faith. They have doubt as well in many instances, or they're completely certain, or they're certain that there is no God, and they're strong and militant in their atheism. I mean, there's a whole continuum. There's even a whole continuum of agnosticism. You know, I know agnostics who say, "Well, I feel pretty good about when I'm in a church or a synagogue or a house of worship. I don't know if I believe, you know, all the things I'm saying, the liturgy and, you know, the reverence and all of that. But nevertheless, I feel that sense of community. I feel a sense of connection with my ancestors or my parents and grandparents. I like the ritual. I like the sacred place and the ideal of a sacred place." And, you know, the nice thing about being an agnostic is you can say, okay, it's fine to go to a house of worship. I remembered in writing this book involuntarily a line from a great old rock and roll song by Elvis Presley that was a gospel song originally. It was a top 10 hit. It was a worldwide hit. It was called "Crying in the Chapel," for some of you old-timers who may recall. And the line of the song hit me. "You saw me crying in the chapel. The tears I shed were tears of joy. I know the meaning of contentment now. I am happy with the Lord." And I thought, wow, you know, to feel that sense of joy and contentment and happiness. I mean, what else are we here on earth for, perhaps, except to feel those kinds of emotions? And that's why I'm envious of people who feel them. That's why I feel spiritual envy. That's why I had to name it and signify it as spiritual envy. Because it's something that I lost. And it's a common enough story, you know. I mean, I lost my faith, I suppose, for the reason most people do. Well, I suppose many people lose their faith because of tragedy and because life doesn't measure up to what they had hoped for or prayed for. But I wanted to be an intellectual, and I read a lot of science, and I read Darwin, and I read Nietzsche, and I read, you know, Schopenhauer, and all of the great thinkers, and Socrates, who is really an agnostic, who said, you know, the only thing I know is that I know nothing. I read Bertrand Russell, who was an early idol of mine, and I read the agnostics. I talk about somewhat irreverently in this book, The Trinity of Agnostics, Bertrand Russell being one of them. He was variously an atheist and an agnostic, depending on his audience. Another being Robert Ingersoll, who was known as the great agnostic, and T.H. Huxley, Aldous Huxley's grandfather, who was the man who gave us the word agnostic and who was known as Darwin's bulldog. I was drawn more and more to agnosticism as an answer to things that aren't answerable. And I was also coming to a kind of light bulb above my head and realization that what I had lost of my childhood in the way of faith was something very precious, was something that represented, can I use a word like cherishable? I don't even know if it's what we call a neologism, a word that you can invent that comes out of actual words, something that deserved to be cherished. That is, when I call it precious and cherish, I mean, when I was a boy, I was absolutely certain that God was watching over me. And I write in the book about not only the comfort of that, but I went through something that, by any standards, was pretty traumatic. I had a teacher, a male teacher in the sixth grade, and I've never seen myself as a victim, frankly. You know, there are lots of people who talk about abuse, and unfortunately they use it in an abusive way to gain sympathy, either internally or from others. It just happens to be a fact that when I was in the sixth grade, I was kind of an active kid and sometimes spoke out of turn and spoke without raising my hand. And this was a kind of old British type of school teacher, I mean from the old school, Swinburne, that type of thing, who would take me literally by the ear and haul me into the boys' restroom and punch and kick and slap and, you know, physically abuse me. Even one occasion, sticking my head into a toilet. And I, you know, I did what I think people need to do when they go through anything resembling this kind of trauma. I moved on with my life and I didn't let it haunt me. I processed it somehow, and frankly, I didn't think about it that much because I wanted to move on with my life, and I was a young, ambitious kid and I wanted to succeed. And there you have it in a nutshell. But it came back to me. A lot of it came back to me in writing this book. And I didn't dwell on it because I didn't want to dwell on it. I never wanted to dwell on it. But what I realized was this. I was getting, as we used to say, getting my ass kicked, literally. And I wanted to be good. I wanted him to think I was a good kid, a good boy. Okay? And I also was intelligent enough to realize that by trying to be good, I wouldn't necessarily incur his wrath and I wouldn't get my ass kicked. Okay. That's a word that's permissible on the radio, by the way. FCC regulations allow it. So I was helping him. I became his helpmate. I began to, you know, put drawings up and clear off the chalkboard and do all these kinds of things. And he asked me to take a can of paint to the room across the hall to the other sixth grade teacher, and I slipped. And the paint went down the whole corridor like a miniature river, yellow paint. And he used to come out, aside from taking me to the boys' room to beat up, he would come out to have a cigarette in the boys' room. And he comes out to the boys' room to have a cigarette, and he sees me standing there, you know, with all this yellow paint going down the corridor. Quite a sight it must have been. But he became ferociously angry and gave me the worst beating he ever gave me. And he said, "Mop it up." And I did. And I was standing there, you know, trying to keep the tears in and everything because, you know, I came from this kind of neighborhood where you never showed emotion lest you be thought of as a sissy. Somebody might see the tears streaming down my face. I kept them in. It's hard. Mopped it up, left, and then went to a little wooded area and started sobbing convulsively. I mean, I can remember it pretty graphically. But I also remember what I said inwardly. And what I said inwardly was, "I was good. God, you know." I didn't even tell my parents about this abuse until years later. Because I, you know, he was my teacher. He was the authority. I was the bad boy. But that certainty that God is up there watching you and knowing that you're good, even when you've been beaten, even when something really so unjust has occurred. I mean, because what can be more unjust than the beating of a child? And it took years and years later, after having read Dostoevsky and the Brothers Karamazov, before I began to think to myself, Ivan Karamazov is right when he says, you know, how can a loving, compassionate God allow such a thing as the beating of a child? This is called theodicy, not theodicy, T-H-E-O-D-I-C-Y, theodicy. That is, that you have to come to some kind of justification for God in a world where there's evil and where there's child molestation and hurricanes and earthquakes and terrible wars and so forth, if you believe. How can you reconcile it? I mean, our founding fathers reconciled it quite easily. They said, we're deists. You know, God made the world and created it. I always am reluctant to speak about our founding fathers because it makes me feel like Glenn Beck. But, you know, look at Jefferson and Hamilton, Madison. I mean, they all believe God made the world, and then he kind of became absent, as it were, and it was up to us in free will to follow his commands and to follow his dictates and to live lives of goodness. Well, I wanted a code, and I think I found one to live by. And when Karamazov says, if God does not exist, anything is permissible, what he means by that philosophically is if there is no God punishing or meting out rewards and punishments, then any kind of evil can take place. Any kind of evil is permissible in a world without God. So I had to grapple with evil. And what does evil mean? I mean, so many of us have an idea. We think we know it. It's like pornography. You know it when you see it, or you know it when you encounter it, and you hope you don't encounter it, and you hope if you do, you know how to combat it. But I found myself wrestling with just the idea of evil. It's palpable, and it can be perhaps characterized. But also goodness. You know, what do we mean by goodness, and why do we aspire to goodness rather than perhaps embracing evil? These became fundamental questions for me. And to some extent, I realized that in grappling with these questions, there was something driving me that was beyond my own understanding, that had to do perhaps with faith in a strange way. I mean, I talk about being attracted to nothingness as a young cerebral romantic man because it's a good way to protect oneself and create armor. And nothingness can be almost romantic in a way. But I rejected nothingness, and yet so many of the writers I admired seemed to be speaking about nothing, as Democritus said, nothing means more than nothing, you know, or nothing will come of nothing, or all sound and fury signifying nothing, all of these things that, you know, literature has taught me about nothingness. And I found something here that I could actually build upon, and it was the illumination that comes through the writing process, which I had really always believed in, deep down. Why did I decide to teach literature as a life vocation? I think it was my belief in literary art, my belief in the power of the written word and the spoken word, but more in many ways having been drawn as a scholar and as a would-be writer to the written word. So there you have it. I thought maybe I would conclude by just reading a short passage. I said that I wrote about the paranormal, and I've got some stories in here. It's not all, you know, kid getting beaten by a sixth-grade teacher. In fact, I go pretty fast through that. I write about time. I write about good and evil, about the Ten Commandments, because one of the big questions is if you don't know if the lawgiver was there, that biblical figure who looks like Charlton Heston, you know, giving out the stone tablets, if you don't know that he is or she is or it is there, then how do you know that you need to believe in the law, despite the fact that it might be in a Mississippi courtroom? I wrote about many things here, obviously, and I also, as I said, wrote about the paranormal. And because I don't view life as entirely tragic by any means, I included some stories and some anecdotes that, well, I like to think bring levity to the book as well, and this is one that I thought I would read. I once interviewed Eric Idle of the Monty Python, and he said to me, there are two forces in the world. There's gravity and levity. And now that we have Stephen Hawking's new book all about gravity preceding the Big Bang, we have levity as well. So I was writing about the paranormal, and I came to this story. And I introduce it by saying a funny and revealing story comes to mind. I had an accountant named Bob Steiner, who was also a magician. I like saying my accountant was a magician. Steiner became rather well-known in the world of skeptics and debunkers and appeared many times on television and radio as a bogus psychic. In fact, he worked with the famous magician James Randi. He and Randi exposed a phony faith healer named Peter Popoff, who used an electronic device that fed him information through an earpiece. Popoff's wife would tell him through the earpiece people's ailments as he approached them in the audience, and he would amaze everyone by noting, supposedly with help from God, what they were suffering from or where they were in pain or what they had been diagnosed as having, all information acquired ahead of time by Mrs. Popoff. Steiner happened to mention to me that he was doing a television show for the Fox Network based on the life of Harry Houdini. He informed me that they were going to do a seance in which they would attempt to get Houdini to speak from the dead, because Houdini had debunked many seances and swore he would communicate from the afterlife if one existed. It all sounded like good entertainment to me, and when I asked Steiner who was producing the show, he told me it was a fellow named Ken Ehrlich. Now, Ken Ehrlich had at one time lived three houses away from me in Cleveland, and we had belonged to the same college fraternity. My sister had been his babysitter when he was a child, and our parents were friends. He had gone on to produce the Emmys and the Grammys. Ehrlich had no way of knowing I knew Steiner. Steiner had impersonated a psychic on many occasions all over the world as part of his debunking crusade, and he was good at it. When set against others who claimed they were real psychics, he inevitably got audiences to believe in the superiority of his psychic powers. Then he would reveal that he was a skeptic and a magician impersonating a psychic. I asked him when he was planning to see Ehrlich, and he told me they had a meeting set up for a week later in Beverly Hills. I proceeded to reveal to him many facts about Ehrlich that few people except those from Ehrlich's past could know. Well, when Steiner met with Ehrlich and Ehrlich's assistant producer, Steiner went almost immediately into his psychic role, insisting right off to two skeptical men that he possessed paranormal powers. To the assistant producer, he made general observations of the sort that anyone might buy into. And then he told Ehrlich that he had never before felt such powerful psychic vibrations as he felt with Ehrlich. He started off by saying he saw a diamond and a couple of older people. Did that have any significance? I had told Steiner that Ehrlich's grandparents' name was Diamond. I had also heard from my mother a few months earlier that she and my father, who were still friendly with Ehrlich's parents, had attended the bar mitzvah of his brother Steve's son in Cleveland. Steiner asked Ehrlich if he had a brother. And when Ehrlich said he did, Steiner asked if there was a recent celebration or ritual having to do with the brother's son. All this was pretty surprising to Ehrlich. But he deduced that Steiner must have talked to his wife. You spoke to my wife, didn't you? Ehrlich asked. Steiner looked Ehrlich right in the eye and sternly said, I swear on everything, including my own life and the lives of my children, that I have never met or talked to your wife. Whereupon he asked Ehrlich another question, gleaned from my supply of information. Had he dated a girl in college with a peg leg? Ehrlich became, according to Steiner's description, highly agitated, exclaiming that his wife didn't know about this girl, who unfortunately had come to be called Peg Leg Betty. Steiner told me he felt compelled at this point to let Ehrlich know the truth because Ehrlich was begging. Steiner blurted out, Mike Krasny says hello. Thank you. Joe, it's in your capable hands
okay,
now.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you. I'll take the ball at this point. Well, thank you very much, Michael Krasny, host of KQED Radio's Forum and author of the new book, Spiritual Envy and Agnostic's Quest. I have here, I was reading this question. I think it's a high-impact question, and it was hard to read, but I think I've got it down, so I'm going to start with this one. Contemplating the awareness, the intelligence, the creativity, and imagination of mankind and the perfection of beauty of nature, do you not think that there is a creative will or wills bringing them into being and into safekeeping?
I'd like to think that, but I don't know. I don't have the proof of it. You know, you can look at nature and you can look at beauty and aesthetic things and you can say there must be something above us. There must be some kind of higher power that willed this into existence. But if you do that, then I think you also have to grapple with the ugliness and the horrors and the carnage and so forth, because that's life. I don't in any way demean or derogate the comfort that can come from that belief. In fact, as I said, I envy it, but I don't have it. And I'm not only envious, but you know, I wish I did have it. My friend Christopher Hitchens, who's now dying and is writing about dying, who is a stone-cold atheist, as many of you know, is dying of esophageal cancer, and he said, I'd like one of these. I was thinking, could Christopher have one of these Brideshead Revisited moments, you know, where you on your deathbed and you're, and he's already written and said, if I say, you know, I found the Creator or acknowledged whatever along those lines, it's not me, it's the chemo and the radiation that's speaking, you know. I mean, so right to the end, he's gone off to whatever his rewards or punishments are, or just the nothingness, by not embracing anything other than his atheism. I don't embrace atheism, but I have found it very difficult to embrace a higher supernal kind of faith as well. That's why I'm in this limbo, and it does seem sort of, if you have a Catholic background, it does seem sometimes like a limbo of agnosticism. But I think there are many of us who are skeptical and who are doubters who are there. And I found that this book, I gave it to friends of mine who are of deep faith, and I gave it to friends of mine who are atheists, and the thing that kind of tickles me, and this is not an advertisement for the book so much as just an observation, is that they found it meaningful to them. So that's very meaningful as an author, obviously, to me.
Well, a couple of questions. I was going to actually save these to the end, but I think it's appropriate now. A couple of questions want to know about the good and bad of religion. Does religion cause more good than evil in the world? I think this is a good time to ask that. And then another question is, can you speak to the problem of all religions causing wars? We're living in that time, it seems, right now.
Well, religions do seem to be catalysts to wars, although sometimes it's hard to separate religion and nationalism. And yet, or fanaticism, or nihilism, I think that 9/11... particularly made many turn against religion because it seemed like it was perpetrated by Islam. Well, it was perpetrated by Islamic fanatics, but I think they were fanatics who had what Twain calls evil joy, and the evil joy of just annihilating and creating chaos and old night, to use John Milton phrase. Religion and all of the terrible things that have been done in the name of religion is simply undeniable. As I said, you think about 9/11, you think about all the things that are done in the name of religion and certainty of belief. And I think a lot of people were turned to atheism, frankly, by the Bush administration, by the idea that that administration with Jerry Falwell and all of these clerics, and the idea that administration had a special pipeline to God and tried to enforce what they believed were, I mean, 1 out of 7 Americans are evangelicals, and they saw the need to enforce that kind of theology in terms of public policies and so forth. And we've got the Crusades, and we've got the Inquisition, and we've got all these wars and all this torture. So let's think about it for a moment. You can understand why people say, religion, go to black. it's all pretty hideous. I don't take that position at all. And I don't take it for a number of reasons. First of all, in terms of intellectual history and American culture and American history is where I'm rooted, I began to think to myself, it's a kind of binary force. You know, the Puritans built this country on religious zealotry, and they built a kind of work ethic that we would not have had a republic had they not had the desire to instill it and propagate it and proselytize it. They burned witches, they killed pagans, they killed Indians. They all did that, in the name of religion too, but they came here to escape from religious persecution, and they established a country that allowed for religious freedom, which is very fortunate that we have in this country, and we should give thanks to whatever power that we have that. But I began to think of religion as this benevolent force too, because it does give people solace. It gives them hope. I thought of Rose Kennedy, for example, when both her sons were mowed down, who still had the rock of her Catholicism. And I thought of all the people I know who were able to ameliorate their own suffering through their faith and through their convictions. I thought of prisoners I worked with a number of years ago when I went to San Quentin who had found a straight and narrow path because of religion and were no longer recidivistic because they had embraced Islam or Christianity or found Jesus as their savior or whatever. I thought of the fact that in addictive programs like Friends of Bill, AA, now they have agnostic and atheist chapters, but You go into addiction sometimes and you find if you believe in a higher power, accept a higher power, or a belief in God can actually take you out of addiction. It does allow people to be free of the devils of addiction. And from an intellectual history standpoint, I thought, would there have been an abolition movement to conquer and vanquish slavery if it hadn't been for the churches and the religious foundation of this country? Would there have been a civil rights movement? Would we have had even what we had in the way of civil rights if it hadn't been for Martin Luther King's belief in Christianity? If it hadn't been for Gandhi, Hinduism, would we have had Gandhi's philosophy and what Gandhi believed? And even, I found myself, and these are all our martyrs, of course, our great icons. I mean, Gandhi gunned down, killed, Martin Luther King killed, Malcolm X killed. Would Malcolm X have transformed his vision to one of us all being of a brotherhood? Because he believed that all white people were devils. But he went on the Hajj to Mecca, and suddenly he saw blacks, whites, people of all color bowing together, and he felt a different sense of the potential for brotherhood, which is the Malcolm X that I revere, El Hajj, as he became known. Okay. We have been very fortunate in many ways. Religion has sown tremendous discord, horrors, things done in the name of religion, but it's given our basis to Western civilization of beliefs in compassion and love and higher nobility and duty, whether we like to think of it or not. Even the atheists will concede this. They have conceded it to me. And I'm not necessarily all that fanatical about making a case for religion. I'm not the defender of the faith. I just see it this way. This is the way I see it because I think this is the way, at least for me, it is.
Well, Michael, every author would be and should be concerned about what critics, either professional critics or the general public, thinks about their book after having read it. I'm not sure what this person means that asked this question about the ultra-Orthodox community or what specifically they mean. But the question, I think, is a good one. How has the ultra-Orthodox community reacted to your book? Now, there's, I'm going to let you run with this. There's many different types of Orthodox communities.
I don't know how the ultra-Orthodox community has reacted to my book. I got a review today in the Jewish Journal that was done by Jonathan Kirsch, an attorney and an author whom I have a lot of respect for. I wrote a book about Moses and a book called The Harlot by the Side of the Road. He's a kind of biblical scholar and was for a while a regular reviewer for the Los Angeles Times. And it was the kind of review that makes an author happy. But I understand a lot of Orthodox, I mean, people of all the Jewish sects, I mean, Reform, Orthodox, Reconstructionists, Conservative, and so forth, read the Jewish Journal. So I don't know what kind of blowback there will be or what kind of result there will be. But I can tell you this, what I call the true believers, this is what Karen Armstrong, whom some of you know, who's really a brilliant theologian, a former nun who's written about God and written about theology, written books on Islam, on Christianity, on Judaism, on all brands of religion, Buddhism, which in some ways is maybe more a practice than a religion, but we won't go there, for many out here at least. What I call the true believers, the fundamentalists, Christians, the Islamic fanatics, the ultra-Orthodox, these are all fundamentalists as far as Karen Armstrong is concerned, and I think she's right. They all have a lot of things in common. They want to kind of move back in time. They want to keep women from being liberated in different respects. I mean, the ultra-Orthodox in Israel, you know, if they see a woman wearing a skirt that's too short, they throw stones at her and so forth. This is not my idea of religion. This is not my idea of, and I make it pretty clear here. And yet, it's what they believe. And as long as they're not trying to foist it on you or me, as long as they're not trying to coerce us, as long as they're not trying to be dogmatic about it in an inflexible way that interferes and does harm with our lives, let them go whatever they want to go.
Well, amongst all the personalities you've interviewed, who had the most thoughtful comments, in your opinion, about their own agnosticism and or atheist beliefs?
The most thoughtful. Well, I don't, you know, immediately I think of the atheists because I've interviewed the trinity of atheists, you know, Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens. And they're brilliant men, to a man. They're really, in different ways, geniuses, I think. But the thoughtfulness wasn't there when it came to being tolerant of religion or believers. I just didn't find it. You know, my father was dying a number of years ago, and I was in Texas, and I was doing a job in Texas. And there were these sweet evangelical women who told me they would pray for me, for my father, excuse me. And I just found it very touching. You know, I mean, I could have said, and I kind of put myself in the mindset of somebody like Dawkins, who might have said, you know, your prayers are going nowhere. There's this alpha male in the sky that you've imagined and fantasized, and all that sort of thing. I could never understand that contemptuousness, even though I understand the enmity and the anger at religion. It's different to go into a kind of contemptuous realm. But that wasn't the question. The question was, who was most thoughtful? You know, I was just asked if I wanted to interview Brian Greene again, who is a physicist, a kind of young genius physicist. And we were talking about cosmology, I recall. And he seemed to me to be very open. And that's what I like when I'm talking to someone. I mean, I won't necessarily call somebody closed-minded, because I like to do interviews, for those of you who listen to the program know, in a civil way. But I think there is a certain kind of closed-mindedness, as much as I admire many of the atheists, the so-called neo-atheists, as I call them. And I've had people of faith on who can be very thoughtful. We've had interfaith dialogue. There's a guy named Jim Donahue who runs the GTU, the Graduate Theological Union, over in Berkeley. It just seems to me to have a real expansive sense of tolerance and openness, and extends that, and can be very thoughtful talking about religious issues. I mean, it's not something I talk about a lot. I enjoy talking about, obviously. I mean, I've been kind of an amateur theologian a lot of my adult life. But when I have those kinds of conversations, or somebody like Jacob Needleman, you know, who is a very sound and rational and thoughtful man in the way he dispenses his brand of philosophy. These are names that just come right to the top, and I'm sorry for some that I may have left out. But, you know, I have the great good fortune of interviewing many exceedingly thoughtful people and some of the brightest people, really, on Earth.
Well, do you mind commenting about your interview with Deepak Chopra and also the Dalai Lama?
And also with?
Dalai Lama.
I never interviewed the Dalai Lama. I've interviewed a lot of Buddhist thinkers and Rinpoches and so forth, but never interviewed the Dalai Lama. I write about some of these. Somebody asked me last night, I was at a bookstore, about Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, and you know, I interviewed him, and I've interviewed a lot of people from high up in many faiths, but not the Dalai Lama. I did interview Deepak Chopra, who, you know, has become a. He told me that he was recently called the King of Wu. Which is sort of interesting, you know, like as in woo-woo. And I haven't liked Deepak. I'll tell you about the interview with Deepak in a moment, but in my last book, Off Mic, I tell a story about Deepak Chopra that is pretty funny. So for the sake of more levity, I'll tell it again, because he was at an event in Marin County, and I introduced him after interviewing him there. And he gave a talk, and some people hovered around him at the end, and a woman who was there pointed her finger right at him. And I tell this story because it's an archetypical Marin County story. Pointed her finger at him and said, "You raped me," and said it with a kind of fierceness that was horrifying. I mean, you could hear a pin drop, and there were gasps. And Deepak looked at her, and he said, "Madam, I've never seen you before in my life." And she said, "I'm not talking about this life." You see, so there you go. I mean, there are people who have that kind of fundamentalist belief, even in reincarnation, past lives. I write about Brian Weiss and Ian Stevenson and some of those folks in this book. Couldn't help going into that territory. He was on recently, and he's written a book about Muhammad. And he also wrote a book about Buddha and about Jesus, and he said his next book is about God. He's ambitious thinker. My kids keep kidding me because somehow this old thing about Deepak being on Oprah and if they married, she'd be Oprah Chopra. And she said, you couldn't really say that. How could you really even say something like that, you know? But it came up. You know, in a way, I kind of like him. He is thoughtful. He means well. I think he's way out there in some instances. I remember having a long kind of discourse with him that was pretty argumentative because he kept talking about how we can extend longevity and keep extending it and maybe, you know, through Ayurvedic medicine and through mind-body connections and all these holistic things, we can live forever. And I said, oh, Deepak, I'm sorry, I have to draw the line there. My agnosticism just... Maybe we can, though. Who knows now? Remember Stuart Brand, the founder of the Whole Earth Catalog, when he turned 60, said to me, I'm just at middle age now. With biotechnology, maybe he's right. Read Gary Steingart's new novel. You know, it's all about people who want to live forever. I mean, it's one of the things, it's a wonderful novel that it's about. It was a good interview, though. We talked mainly about Muhammad.
Okay.
And you can listen to it in our archives.
Well, let's take a break for a second. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program, and our speaker today is Michael Krasny, host of KQED Radio's Forum program, who is discussing his own exploration of spirituality as well as his life and his career. Michael, last week, 33 miners survived 70 days in a deep mine in Chile. Mm-hmm. Do you think there could have been some, quote-unquote, unforeseen forces behind this miraculously executed survival and rescue operation? Would you like to interview some of these miners, assuming that they spoke English?
The answer is yes. I would like to interview some of the miners. I'd particularly be curious about the one who was met by his wife and his mistress. But I must tell you that I felt the euphoria probably many of you felt. We talked about it on the air. I had people call in and express their elevated emotion and those moments of joy where you can just feel something almost mystical coursing through you and wonderful. And I mean, it was a moment to really savor as they came out, as each of them came out. It was something that was really wonderful. And of course, you know, the mind immediately goes to, was this miraculous? I mean, because in many ways it was miraculous. And the person who wrote the question, used the word miraculous. But again, how do we judge miracles? And how do we, what about, of course, the miracles that didn't occur? What about the fact that there was someone in Pennsylvania making a certain kind of drill that was a product of the new technology that had been unheralded? I mean, things came together. I write in this book about things that seem extraordinary, a number of things that seem extraordinary. And one of the stories I tell, which is a true story that happened in a place called Mentor, Ohio, near where I grew up, was a man who lost his son. Mentor is on a lake, and the son was out in a boat, and the boat was vacant, and they dragged and dragged through the water trying to find him using all the modern technology, and they couldn't find his body, and the father wanted the body, and the father prayed for the body, and it was lost. It seemed to be just... that they couldn't find it. And a good deal of time had gone by, and he'd gone through mourning, and he went out on his boat to fish, the father alone. And somehow, I know this sounds like, you know, grotesque story out of Ripley's Believe It or Not or something, somehow he managed to hook on to his son's body with his fishing reel and found his son's body. Now, a story like that, and there are a lot of stories like that in my book, a story like that, you can interpret so many ways. Just like the Chilean miners, you can say there must have been a higher force operating. There has to have been. How else could something so unlikely, so extraordinary have occurred? Well, I'm here to tell you that you have to look at these things skeptically as well and say some of these things that seem miraculous occur, some of these things do not occur. They can give you hope, they can make you feel wonderful and euphoric, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a hidden force that's invisible to us, that's pushing things or orchestrating things. It's what Faulkner called the stage manager, right? It's a good explanation of the kind of God that many of us have had from our youth when we think there must have been this higher force that helped these people out and saved them because it's so extraordinary. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know.
One of the fun things for me in doing this Q&A with you, Michael, is that you've interviewed so many phenomenal people, and so to learn about these people through your eyes and your ears and what you can tell us is really a great opportunity for all of us. And I want to ask you about Saul Bellow. I recall one of your favorite interviews was the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, Saul Bellow. And during the Depression, he was a communist sympathizer. In fact, specifically, he fell into a camp referred to as the Trotskyites. Was he also a non-believer at that time? And how about in his later life?
And I'm sorry, what was the last part?
Oh, how about in his later life? Was he a non-believer, or did he become a believer?
Bellow was someone I admired a great deal. And is this question from you, Joe, or from the audience?
It's from me.
Oh, okay. It's funny. You kind of personalized it, so I wanted to
That's
find
right.
out.
Yeah.
The way I read Bellow, especially later on in life, and he did shift politics. He became, in some ways, much more conservative. I mean, it wasn't quite as dramatic as, say, someone like Dos Passos or Jack Kerouac, but he did become certainly somewhat conservative. Later on in life, when he wrote From Jerusalem and Back, you know, and he began to ponder some of the bigger questions, because he went to Israel and he was a Jew, and all of that flooded his consciousness. And I think that that Bellow believed in goodness. He believed in what, well, there's a Yiddish word for it. It's called Menschlichkeit. You know, there's Yiddishkeit, which is the Yiddish culture, and there's Menschlichkeit, which is the culture of being a mensch, of being a good person. It used to be almost a sexist word. Being a mensch meant being a good boy or a good man, right? And Bellow wrestled with that, especially in his younger life and later on. And he wrestled with the big philosophical questions. And because he was a mentor to me and someone whom I admired greatly, I think I've, in many ways, assimilated a lot of Bellow's thinking, maybe even more than I'm conscious of. I think I would call Saul Bellow an agnostic as far as faith is concerned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bertrand Russell, you did gloss over for a moment in your remarks about Bertrand Russell, but what is the significance of Bertrand Russell's 1927 speech entitled, Why I Am Not a Christian?
Well, it's a very significant speech. It's often cited by atheists and agnostics, and it had a great deal of impact. It was given to the Secular Society in London, and in fact, I'll tell you a story that, again, I find fascinating. I was writing about that particular speech in this book, and I was also in the midst of reading a Philip Roth novel. And I put down some words on paper about the speech by Bertrand Russell, and then I went back to the Roth novel. And in the Roth novel, the character, who's an atheist, quotes Bertrand Russell's speech. Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, when you have these kind of anecdotes, and I had a lot of them to tell, you say, is there a pattern behind this? You know, Jung believed in all this serendipity and coincidences, and they must mean something, and maybe they do. I don't know. Russell was pretty sure they didn't. Russell was a non-believer. But Russell was also someone who, in that speech, pretty much laid out a template of why he did not accept Christianity, even though he was brought up in it, and even though from birth he was identified as, in his own mind as well as in the mind of his forebears and his family and so forth, as being Christian. And he was talking about Christianity from some of the baleful sides of what it is, of what's been done in the name of religion, of course. And to this day, it's a very powerful essay, and one that, you know, I would recommend. I found Russell very compelling, even as a young man. And I have a chapter in here on time where I quote Russell. He was a mathematician. He was quite brilliant. But I quote him because what he said made an immense amount of sense to me in terms of proving things empirically. He said, and some of the great mystics say, the real mystery of our existence is time and how we come to grips with it, how in consciousness we understand it or comprehend it, how we feel time, the flux of time. That's why I wrote a good deal about Beckett and Waiting for Godot, because I thought we're all waiting. If it's not waiting for God or waiting for enlightenment, we're waiting, nevertheless, within our mortality. It's our situation of being human. But also, nothing like Waiting for Godot, for me, gives us the flux of time, of our impermanence. Nothing happens and then nothing happens again, you know, and you have to fill in the time somehow in a way before you check out. Well, Russell said, how do we know that everything that we know, right? We're here now in the Commonwealth Club. You all have lives. You all have families or friends or acquaintances. You all have histories, personal and otherwise. How do you know it all wasn't created a nanosecond ago with everything put into our memories and our consciousness? We don't. We really don't know that. And I remember reading that as a kid in Bertrand Russell in Unpopular Essays, which includes Why I'm Not a Christian, and thinking, wow. I mean, it was just like, he's right about time. It's something that you can't grasp and you can't hold on to. And so a lot of people found this chapter on time very compelling, which pleases me, but I found myself saying, it really is about impermanence. It's about transitoriness. So what can we say to give meaning to life? I mean, particularly the big question, right? If we haven't found faith. And it's funny, it came to me in a strange moment. The playwright August Wilson, African-American playwright who wrote Fences and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and, you know, also Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, great talent, was dying. He was dying of pancreatic cancer. And he knew he didn't have much time left. In fact, his doctors told him he had, I think, a couple months, and he lived not even those couple months. And somebody asked him, it was from the New York Times, said to him, well, you know, you're dying and, you know, you're on the precipice and it's certain right up ahead. What can you say? How do you reflect on this? He said, I've had a blessed life. I thought, wow, you know, if you can say that, you're saying a lot. And maybe it's the most you can say. And maybe you don't even think there's a blessing to be had. I dedicated this book to my parents, and I said, if there's blessed memory, you're there. I don't know what's blessed. I don't know what's cursed. I know that I can savor things in life, and I can bless things in life and feel something of a soul, even though, as I point out in the book, there's no soul in Grey's Anatomy. And I believe existentially that we are alone, and we remain alone, and we die alone. But there's still so many things to savor, so many things to cherish. Does that give life meaning, a higher meaning, a more supernal meaning? I don't know. But it's enough. It's enough for me at any rate. And I talk about a friend of mine who's a cardiologist who's going to be 70 years old this Sunday, in fact, and having a party, who said to me, because he sees death all the time, as somebody who does cardiology work that I'm wont to do, and he says, I've done everything I want to do in this life. You know, I mean, I've traveled the place I want to go, had a career that's been meaningful, children, grandchildren, love, good friendships, moments of joy, rapture, ecstasy, you know, those moments, whatever they can feed in the way of memory, even if it was all created just a nanosecond ago. I think there you have it, at least for me at this point. I may have a Brightside Revisited moment. I may have, you know, a moment where it all comes crashing down on me, or, you know, I'm in the foxhole or whatever, or suddenly there's blinding illumination. But if I don't, well, I hope this time around is as good a time as it can be, because I'm pretty sure there aren't any other times around. Dylan Thomas said it best for me when I was a kid and read Dylan Thomas. After the first death, there is no other. Sorry.
Well, it sounds like you were signing off, but I am going to squeeze in one last quick question. We are basically almost out of time. Michael, what did you teach your children regarding faith when they were young?
Well, I was brought up in the Jewish faith, and it's been a rich heritage for me, and it remains culturally and in so many ways something that I cherish. Philip Roth once made a distinction between Judaism and Jewishness, and it's a good distinction. Jewishness being more the ethnicity and the identity than the religion. And I wanted my children to at least have some of that. So, you know, I sent them to Sunday school, religious school, Hebrew school, those kinds of things that I went through. Sometimes they felt, oh, you went through it and you have to make us go through it, you know, punishing us or whatever. But I think it helped them. Sometimes it was almost reductio ad absurdum for me. You know, we belonged to this temple in San Francisco, Sherith Israel, and I'd go in there and there'd be drawings by kids on the wall. There'd be a drawing of Abraham, and next to the drawing before Sun Yi was a picture of Woody Allen and Steven Spielberg. You know, this has become like Jewish identity sort of through from Abraham to celebrities. But my parents gave me a very clear sense of trying to live an ethical, good life, because they did. And if that means something to you and you have children, and if you're on board with your mate and see things that way, and fortunately, it's been my good fortune to have a wife who sees things pretty much the way I do in terms of what we wanted to communicate to our children, the kind of legacy we wanted to give them. And it's funny, my father-in-law, in fact, was known as Ira the Good because he did so many good deeds and because he did good deeds without necessarily wanting the recognition for them and all that. So that sense of wanting to communicate the importance of doing good was above all paramount in terms of what I tried to, and being mindful of public service and being mindful of doing what you can for other people when they can be helped. It was pretty much the ethos that I tried to communicate to my children.
Well, our thanks to Michael Krasny, host of KQED Radio's Forum program and author of the new book, Spiritual Envy, An Agnostic's Quest. We also thank our audience here as well as on the radio and the Internet. We want to remind everyone that Michael's book is on sale in the lobby and he will sign copies of his book in this room immediately following the program. My name is Joe Epstein. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you all.